Good afternoon, and welcome to On the Docket. I'm your host, Patricia Salkin, Dean of Touro Law Center in Central Islip. Every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today on the docket, we're talking about voting rights and what you should know about how your own rights function and what's happening in our country today. On our show today, we're joined by Benjamin Griffith. Ben is a partner in the Cleveland, Mississippi law firm of Griffith & Griffith, and he has a multi-state federal and state civil rights practice that focuses on representing local government entities in voting rights, election law, government tort liability, and First Amendment litigation, as well as private sector insurance in premises liability and construction defect litigation, and public sector insurers in insurance coverage disputes. He's been nominated by his peers to Best Lawyers in America and Mid-South Super Lawyers in the field of municipal law each year since 2006. Ben has been invited to speak at over 100 seminars and conferences in the USA and internationally on state and local government subjects within his area of expertise. And he's editor and chapter author of numerous peer-reviewed publications, including editor of the first and second editions of America Votes, A Guide to Modern Election Law and Voting Rights, which is published by the American Bar Association. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law and teaches a skills course focusing on municipal law practice. We're glad you can join us today, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dean Salkin. I'm glad to be with you.
So, Ben, you and I go back a long time with the American Bar Association State and Local Government Law Section. You also serve on the ABA Standing Committee on Election Law. You have participated in numerous amicus briefs and ABA policy statements in the area of election law. And most recently, you had an opportunity to be engaged and follow closely the U.S. Supreme Court case of Shelby County versus Holder. And I suspect that many of our listeners have no idea what Shelby County versus Holder is, but they should care about what the U.S. Supreme Court had to say. So can you fill us in on this case?
I'll be glad to, Dean Salkin. The Voting Rights Act was enacted in 1965. It met with fierce resistance from the Southern legislators, representatives, and senators. When it was finally passed, it was hailed as the crown jewel of the Civil Rights Act for good reason. One of the key provisions in the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was Section 5. We call it Section 5 preclearance provision. This is the provision that was at issue in the Shelby County versus Holder case decades later. In a nutshell, the Section 5 preclearance provision said that Southern jurisdictions and other covered or jurisdictions subject to the Voting Rights Act preclearance requirement would have to first either have those their changes in voting rights, changes in election laws, changes in election procedures, redistricting plans, and so forth, pre-cleared or approved by the Justice Department or by the District of Columbia District Court, a three-judge court. This pre-clearance mechanism was specifically designed to shift the momentum from the jurisdictions that were violating minority voting rights to the against the better judgment of the Supreme Court and the law of the land to a mechanism that put the burden upon the jurisdiction making an election law change to prove that it did not have the purpose or effect of denying or depriving or abridging the voting rights of minorities. That preclearance mechanism proved to be very effective, and in 1965 it was based upon a tremendous and a very strong record of discrimination in the electoral franchise that directly and substantially affected the voting rights of African Americans and other minorities. That was enacted as a temporary provision. It was reenacted in 1970, 75, extended in 1982, and most recently in 2006, the Voting Rights Act Reauthorization Amendment. At the time those amendments were approved by Congress, it was virtually a unanimous House and Senate that spoke. But very shortly after the 2006 legislation extending the preclearance provision. Suit was filed and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court at that time said, look, we have concerns that the data, the cases, the examples of discrimination, the evidentiary basis has become stale. It may be we're relying upon outmoded data or examples that are remote in the past. That was just a warning shot. 4 years later, the Shelby County versus Holder case reached the U.S. Supreme Court, and a 5-4 majority found not that Section 5 preclearance was unconstitutional, but that the trigger for it, that is, the mechanism by which it was made applicable to jurisdiction, was based upon outmoded or too old data, data that dated back to 1965 and earlier. In an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, the court made it very, very clear that it was not declaring the Voting Rights Act preclearance provision constitutionally insufficient, but the mechanism, the trigger by which it was applied to state and other jurisdictions was found to be unconstitutional. Well, that basically said the oversight provided and the oversight that was in effect for many of the southern jurisdictions, jurisdictions in California, the Bronx, in certain areas of the Chicago precincts, and many other areas in the country, was removed. It was effectively immobilized. Within hours of the Shelby County versus Holder decision, legislation that had been targeted and had been challenged in Texas and other states was immediately brought forward by their respective attorneys general. One of these was the Texas voter identification law, and it was by the Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott. It was announced by his office that that would go into effect immediately. In other words, no oversight mechanism in place, no Section 5 preclearance requirement in effect, and you've got attorneys general in multiple jurisdictions announcing, well, we're ready to implement and put into effect voter ID, and they did it. We've got in Texas and North Carolina and also in Alabama and my home state of Mississippi efforts to move forward with voter ID laws that were previously, up until this time, held at bay by the Section 5 preclearance. When you remove the Section 5 preclearance mechanism, these states and many other states began enacting voter restrictions, election law restrictions, perceived by many as either voter suppression or clearly violative of the voting rights of minorities. There's quite a bit of literature that's been generated in that area and many, many recent decisions that have come down the pike that are relevant to this discussion as well.
So you talked about voter ID as one of the major issues here. There are battles in various states. Are they still raging after this case, like in Texas, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina?
Yes, they are raging, and I'm not going to say it's out of control, but the litigation has reached a peak. We're at a point now where the voter ID litigation in Texas has been litigated. Final arguments were just the day before yesterday. I read where one of my friends, Richard Delheim, with the U.S. Justice Department, had made the closing argument for the Justice Department in the Southern District of Texas courtroom in which voter ID was being challenged. The essential argument was that the voter ID legislation had a disproportionate negative impact upon the ability of minority citizens, Hispanic citizens, as well as African-American citizens, to vote, to exercise their right to register, and to take part in the political process. The other challenges were filed in North Carolina. That case reached a peak and is still, I'm not sure if they're going to appeal beyond the three-judge court, but that case has reached the point where the North Carolina federal court said that voter ID would be allowed, it would be in effect for the upcoming elections in 2014. That was a big blow to the opponents of that legislation. They fought it with every existing and remaining weapon at their disposal under the Voting Rights Act. Other cases in which the voter ID requirement was engrafted onto election laws came from previously uncovered states, that is, states that had not been subject to the Voting Rights Act preclearance provision. One of these was Ohio, and in that case, I believe it was, let me back up just a minute. One of these cases was very much in the public view from Pennsylvania. It was the Vivian Applewhite voter ID case. And as I've told Brooks before, Vivian Applewhite was probably the poster child for the abuses and the suppression potential that voter ID can have. In the Applewhite decision, and it was tried in state court, the Commonwealth Court of Pennsylvania, the determination was made by Judge McGinley that voting laws are designed to assure a free and fair election, and here the voter ID law did not further that goal. The court found that a substantial threat existed to the franchise of hundreds of thousands of registered electors and uncounted qualified electors. And despite the claim by the Pennsylvania government that their efforts were continuing to strengthen and clarify voter education and provide compliant identification to those hundreds of thousands of electors, the federal court said, "I'm not convinced," and that the plaintiffs, in fact, has established a clear right to relief from enforcement of the voter ID provisions in voter ID law. Mm-hmm. Here's the clincher. Ms. Applewhite is like everybody's grandmama. She didn't even have a birth certificate. She never needed one. She didn't have a driver's license because she didn't need to drive, didn't know how to. She didn't have the available forms of voter ID, and there were no alternatives, no less restrictive alternatives for her. Now, besides the Pennsylvania case, there were cases in, besides Texas and North Carolina, there were other cases that came through in which these challenges are still pending. All of them have the same basic legal argument. When you require minority citizens to come forward with a form of voter identification that they have to pay for, something that they have to spend money in order to obtain, argued that this is, in effect, a poll tax, that it has the same financial burden and has the same potential effect of barring a person who would otherwise be able to vote freely.
Some of these issues are just crazy. In 2014, that we're dealing with people's right to vote. Thank you very much, Ben. You're listening to On the Docket with Torah Law Dean Patricia Salkin on Long Island News 103.9. We're joined by Ben Griffith, a lawyer from Mississippi, who has a multi-state federal and state civil practice that focuses on today's topic, which is voting rights. So, Ben, can you talk to us about the Voting Rights Act Amendment of 2014? That's moving through Congress, and any recent developments or things that we ought to be aware of?
Yes, Professor Salkin. The Voting Rights Act, Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014 is a bipartisan proposal on which hearings were initially held just this past June. It seeks to restore, through use of current substantial evidence of prior discrimination, the same protection that was provided under the preclearance mechanism that was immobilized in Shelby County versus Holder. Those hearings have been initial. They've taken place. There's been setbacks, though. A group that moves with amazing speed presented a petition with about a half a million names asking that the Voting Rights Amendment Act be placed before the House and the Senate and that it be voted on. A broad coalition of civil rights, labor, and progressive leaders actually went to Speaker John Boehner's Longworth House office building on or about September 17, just a short while ago. His office was locked. You know, we're dealing with a polarized Congress. And we're dealing with a House that is not wanting through its majority to deal with this issue. And you've got a half a million Americans and leading organizations involved in the Voting Rights Act for Today coalition, demanding that this fight move forward to restore the Voting Rights Act protection. So in a nutshell, yes, this is moving in Congress. It's going to take a lot of citizen involvement. That means letters, contacts with your congressman. I think from the standpoint of New York and surrounding the northeastern states, there appears to be a very strong basis and movement that is, I think, very effective. It is working forward now in correspondence, communications, letters. It's not just the usual push, but it's actually one in which the organized community is reaching out to all sectors of Congress and trying to push this matter forward to get it on the docket, get it before the Congress so that they can act on it.
Right, and it's good to know that New York is participating and that people who live on Long Island can certainly participate by reaching out to our elected representatives in Congress. So, Ben, I just want to move to another topic. We have lots of colleges and universities here on Long Island. This has long been an issue in New York, students' rights to vote in their college community, students' right to vote in general, and access to the voter enrollment forms. What's going on in this area?
There was a major decision handed down on July 24 of this year by the Supreme Court of the state of New Hampshire. The case is Anna Marie Guare, G-U-A-R-E, versus state of New Hampshire. It dealt with a student voting restriction. It was essentially a provision of New Hampshire law that imposed a condition that voters have an intent to live in New Hampshire for an indefinite future, and that they had to have, for example, a driver's license that showed an indefinite intent to reside in New Hampshire. Well, most college students don't know where they're going to be in 2, 3, 4 years, but they know where they are. And this had the effect of disenfranchising a massive number of college students. The decision, I think, was stupendous. It was one in which the court said adding this language to the state voter registration form was confusing and an unreasonable description of the law, and the court refused to allow it to stand. It's a major decision, I think, that strikes strongly in favor of student voting rights and against restrictive, unnecessary residency restrictions.
So, excellent. That is a positive development. There, before we close out the show today, there are two other issues I wanted to talk to you about. Both of them are being undertaken by the American Bar Association with the Voting Rights and Election Law Committee, and both of them, again, have a Long Island connection. One is enhancing the protection of the right to vote and the electoral access by disabled persons, and two, even more specifically, is encouraging jurisdictions to adopt emergency contingency plans to protect the right to vote and the election process when natural or man-made disasters take place at or near the time of elections, just like we had coming up on the 2-year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy.
Yes. These are two provisions. Technically, they're called Section 113A and 113B, approved by the American Bar Association at the meeting of its House of Delegates this past August in Boston. I can say this, that Dean Salkin and I were serving as delegates from the state and local government law section. Both of these provisions received unanimous approval from the House of Delegates. The first one, 113A, deals with emergency contingency plans. That's in direct response to things like the hurricane to hit our East Coast, hit New York. My daughter's in New York, so it's more than a passing interest when we have disasters in that part of the country. This sets up a plan methodology or contents that should set out the alternative locations for elections, backup and preservation of election and voter data, storage and testing of backup voting equipment, and effective plans for communicating with voters in emergencies. The other, 113B, is an extension of our disability rights statutory regime, and it would ask that federal, state, and local governments ensure that the electoral process and voting methods are accessible to persons with disabilities, and ABA has gone on record as strongly supporting this measure.
That's terrific, and thank you very much for your leadership in those areas. I think that wraps it up for us here on the docket. Ben Griffith, thank you very much for joining us today. You clearly are one of the leading attorneys in voting rights litigation, and voting rights policy and civil rights in the United States, and we are really grateful for your participation. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and don't forget to join us again next week for On the Docket. The show airs every Sunday at 4:30 on Long Island News 103.9. For Toro Law Center, I'm Dean Patricia Salkin, and have a great week.